This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Richard Lawson, and I'm here today with Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
And David Canfield.
Hello.
Well, we three future festival goers have a lot to talk about today because the Venice Film Festival has announced its full lineup, while Toronto, which happens basically a week later, keeps adding to their roster. I don't know. The Toronto strategy this year has been interesting. It feels like they're announcing one big title every 2 days. And later in the episode, we'll talk about the Black Panther trailer that came, or Wakanda Forever, rather, trailer that came out of Comic-Con over the weekend. And we'll have a spoilery discussion of the film Nope, which opened last Friday. So if you don't want to hear spoilers, you can just end the episode after we talk about Wakanda Forever. But yes, film festival announcements have happened. The big one from Toronto at the end of last week was The Fablemans. Were you two as surprised as I was to hear that this is a Toronto world premiere?
Shocked.
Yep.
Definitely shocked.
He's never been, for one thing.
Yeah. It feels like they're doing something different with this one. You know, we have all heard this is a much more personal story for Spielberg. And so I think they're going to take a whole new path for how they introduce this film to the world. And this is a huge deal for Toronto.
Yeah, it's a huge deal for Toronto. I mean, Spielberg, the last movie he had at a film festival was, I believe, the BFG out of competition at Cannes.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
But other than that, he really is not a festival filmmaker. No. Like, he'll have something that comes out at the end of the year that premieres on its own, separate of any festival or anything. And then, you know, his blockbuster movies, you know, those are summer, spring movies. So this is interesting. And for people listening who aren't maybe as intimately familiar with the sort of undulations of these film festivals as we are, Toronto is the biggest one and it gets a ton of movies. But a lot of times those movies have already premiered at Venice or Telluride. It's rarer to get a movie of this stature that world premieres at Toronto. But it's not unheard of. Especially when you consider films like Belfast or Green Book, which are movies that are sort of engineered, if you want to be cynical about it, to win that coveted People's Choice Award, which is oftentimes a great precursor to a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a boon to the campaign already, is it's a Steven Spielberg movie in Toronto, so it's going to have a bit of a leg up there. I remember Lincoln premiered at the New York Film Festival.
Yes, right, okay.
And I think generally the move broadly makes sense for the movie to make a festival play because of exactly what Rebecca said. It is not of the usual scale and commercial appeal of a Steven Spielberg movie, including just last year's West Side Story, which did pretty well awards-wise without going to a festival. It was the Best Picture nominee and won an acting Oscar and all that. Yeah, I do also think it's partly... there does seem to be some momentum behind Toronto having a really big comeback year. Like, you've also seen stuff like Knives Out 2, which is called A Glass Onion, and The Woman King with Viola Davis and a really great supporting cast from Gina Prince-Bythewood that feel like really classic TIFF premieres, big commercial movies that also really could use that festival kickoff. And having the combination of those with these more specialty TIFF premieres, still have great starry casts and all that, but feel more in the Telluride Venice vein. And then you're going to also surely have a lot of Telluride Venice films that have already premiered. Like you were saying, Richard, you're going to have a really, really strong slate after 2 years of Toronto kind of playing at best second fiddle to those Labor Day weekend festivals and premieres.
Yeah, I mean, Toronto has, it serves a great function in the, you know, the film calendar every year, but because it's the most attended festival, it is in a lot of ways the most accessible, given that it's in a city that's close to New York, close to a lot of American cities, not a terribly long flight from Europe. It's always had a really important function, but it had, I think, been losing a bit of its identity as Venice got bigger and bigger in terms of, you know, I don't think that the Venice Festival programmers would describe themselves this way, but or their own festival this way, but like it has become the sort of most important clearinghouse for the Oscars increasingly, as well as some big commercial fair here and there. So to have all these world premieres, especially a Steven Spielberg memoir piece, that feels really significant. Though one could, on the flip side of things, say, is this an indicator that it's maybe very broadly populist, like Belfast or Green Book or whatever? You know, is it maybe not as arty or elevated, I guess, as some of us would hope? I mean, maybe that's kind of a snobby thing to say, but like that is some of the whispers I've been hearing since that announcement.
Yeah, I thought of that too.
Yeah, I mean, it might just not be the movie that I expected it to be, given, I mean, we don't know really much about it. We know who's in it. I keep hearing that, like, Michelle Williams is going to be the big Oscar hopeful for that. But beyond that, I mean, everyone's going to find out in Toronto, which I think for that festival is very exciting. And it's a much bigger platform than I think a kind of more private, you know, December premiere would be.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's so much expectation built up around that one for a film that we know not that much about and have seen nothing of. But I think you're right. There's definitely a lot of pressure on it to perform. And that could, of course, lead to a little disappointment if it's not what we think it's going to be.
Yeah, the Grosch People's Choice Award is to lose at this point.
Yeah.
So if anything but victory there is a disappointment, I think. Well, speaking of films that we don't know, well, I mean, it's kind of a very, we know a lot about, let's say, Blonde, the Andrew Dominik, Marilyn Monroe adaptation. Well, we know enough about it, I guess. We know about Aronofsky's The Whale. I'm talking about all the movies that have been announced as Venice Film Festival premieres, which is quite a hearty lineup this year. Rebecca, what jumped out to you most? Like, what are you most excited to see the reaction to?
Well, David and I did a little analysis of this lineup, which is on the site now, and I feel like I'm so excited about it. I think they have so much that I'm really hopeful for. The couple that stands out to me, obviously, Todd Field's first film in 15 years is a big deal, and also, speaking of high expectations, I think has those. And then I'm really curious about the Aronofsky film, The Whale. I just think it's kind of an embarrassment of riches when we look at this lineup.
Yeah, the Todd Field film is called Tar. It's a biopic, I believe, of a orchestral conductor played by Cate Blanchett. And they, on Monday of this week, released a odd little teaser trailer for it that is of... Did any of you see Manifesto, which was this kind of traveling video art project that Cate Blanchett did, and then they turned it into a film that I think you could see in theaters?
Yes.
It had that sort of slow-mo, arty vibe while there's this voiceover narration about God and obliteration, and I don't know. It was it doesn't really give you a sense of what that movie's going to be until the last seconds of the trailer, in which you see Cate Blanchett wielding a conductor's baton mightily, and you know. So I'm, you know, this is a guy, Todd Field, who has not made a movie since Little Children, which was what, 2007?
2006, I believe.
2006, so even longer. And then previous to that, he had In the Bedroom. He's really only made those two films. There's been stuff rumored in between 2006 and now, most notably, I think, an HBO adaptation of Beautiful Ruins, the novel that that never came to be. So yeah, I agree. That one is probably, I didn't think that was going to be there. Maybe I should have, but I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, that 90-minute trailer, or however long it was, would have fit quite cleanly into the manifesto.
Yeah,
it was also a reminder that this is a Todd Field movie. He is kind of known for trailers like that. And I was very surprised and very excited by it. Yeah, once they put something like that out, you can pretty much guarantee that the festival campaign is up and running. Yeah, I think there's a lot of performances to be on the lookout for, as ever, that being one of them. Florian Zeller is back with the son following the father. Will the Holy Ghost be next? Stay tuned. This one stars Hugh Jackman, Vanessa Kirby, and Laura Dern. So two Oscar nominees and an Oscar winner. And he writes very rich material for actors generally in his theater work. And as we know from his past last film, his film work as well. So that's one that I think could definitely kickstart a few races at the very least. And Netflix, once again, has a pretty hefty slate here. I think they've got two of the most anticipated movies of the fall. The new movie from Alejandro Iñárritu, Bardo. It's got another double title like Birdman. False Chronicle of a Handful of Truths.
He needs to stop doing that.
We're just calling it Bardo, guys. We're not saying it anymore.
This is the only time. Yes.
We will never say that again.
Yeah. Well, actually, Tar, the style is, it has the accent on the A and it's all capitalized, Richard. So I'm not sure how we're going to deal with that one.
Yeah.
Yes, but as for Bardo, it's another comedy for him. His last comedy that premiered at Venice was Birdman. That went on to win Best Picture. And actually, Iñárritu has won Best Director for his last two features. So obviously one to look out for. And then probably my most anticipated is White Noise, Noah Baumbach's new movie with Adam Driver and Greta Gerwig with fantastic hair based on the first look still they released as part of the announcement. It's opening the festival. It's an adaptation of the Don DeLillo novel. It's a bigger swing from Baumbach than I think we're used to, and as a huge fan of his stuff, I'm really intrigued by how he's going to spin that book, because it's pretty notorious as a tough-to-adapt novel.
Yeah, I remember years and years ago at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, my parents had season tickets, and they took us to see a play called Valparaiso that was written by Don DeLillo. I think it might have been based on a short story or a novel of his, or maybe it was just an original play. But either way, at the time, it was the most boring thing I'd ever seen in my life. And so I have this like innate Don DeLillo like aversion. So I'm cautiously curious about that one. But I was also probably 12 years old. So I should give myself a little credit.
That's a formative experience right there.
I think it's interesting that White Noise is the opening film. I mean, that's clearly the festival trying to set some kind of tone. What tone, I don't know exactly. Opening night selections can mean a variety of things. It can be something they kind of want to get out of the way, something they really want to kick off the festival with a bang, or just something kind of like, I think that when I went to Venice the first time in 2019, it was the Corrida film. So, you know, which was kind of a mild, not terribly earth-shaking film. So I think the Baumbach will probably loom a little bit larger than that.
Yeah, last year was Parallel Mothers, so.
Okay, yeah.
Does everyone else think Adam Driver is looking more and more like Noah Baumbach in every film he does? Like, now he has the same haircut as him.
It's like the Jane Campion thing, you know, just sometimes she just wants some of her actors to look like her. I could definitely see it. Or Christopher Nolan does that too, right? Like the shaggy blonde hair and the, yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I think I feel very hopeful for the Baumbach, and I do think it being the opening night film is promising, and I feel like that's definitely one of my most anticipated as well.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/littlegoldmen.
Do you think Blonde, again, the Marilyn Monroe biopic starring Ana de Armas, for which we have a very brief little teaser where we hear her Marilyn voice just a tiny bit, do you think that that being at Venice in competition, does that say anything to either of you about how we should be anticipating that film? Because the rumors have ranged from it's an NC-17 masterpiece to it's an NC-17 disaster and everywhere in between. So I'm curious about where you are all on Blonde at the moment.
I feel like there were rumors last year that Venice had turned it down and it had started spiraling from there, actually. So I guess this is a sign that Venice didn't despise it, which some people seem to believe. I'm not putting too much stock in it yet. It definitely shows that Netflix is taking the film seriously, which maybe shouldn't be a huge surprise. There's a lot of anticipation around it. And there's going to be, I would guarantee, a lot of reactions to both her performance and to Andrew Dominik's rendering of Marilyn Monroe. He is sure to provoke some very, very, very strong opinions. And that seems to be where we're at. And I don't really know what we can say beyond that that hasn't already been said.
Yeah, that to me feels like one of those things where you see it at Cannes or Venice or some international festival that isn't Toronto, and it plays well there, and you're like, yeah, let's see how that does when it gets to North America.
Yes.
What I have heard about Blonde, and I might be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure this is the main knowledge on it, is that like the reason it's NC-17 is for explicit sex, including sexual violence. And I could see the Euro crowd at Venice being like, sure. And then it landing with a thud at Toronto or somewhere else. So it could have one of those precipitous falls once it leaves that sort of Euro climb. I don't know.
Yeah. This seems like the best launch for it. However far it goes from there, this seems like where they should be starting it off.
And is it Netflix too?
Yes.
Yeah. So they couldn't be at Cannes because of those rules. So this was definitely its best bet. One other film I was genuinely surprised to see on the list, because I had frankly kind of forgotten about it despite us all talking about it a couple months ago, is the Martin McDonagh film, The Banshees of Inisherin, which is a reunion for In Bruges stars Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell, correct? And it's another one of his little... He has a kind of series of plays, and I guess now a film, that are set on these little Irish islands. The Cripple of Inishmen, which Daniel Radcliffe did on Broadway a few years ago. The Lieutenant of Inishmore, which was a big hit on Broadway, I don't know, probably 15, 16 years ago. So I'm curious about this because a Venice premiere leads me to suspect that this is definitely a McDonagh film that is going for awards, much in the way that Three Billboards did.
Yeah, we have a very splashy first look on vanityfair.com that folks interested can read. I've seen the movie, and I cannot say anything beyond what is in that piece, but I think you're exactly right on the money, Richard, in that it resembles his theatrical work more. It's the first Irish feature he has made, despite at this point a pretty healthy film career. It does reunite Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell. I think it's pretty safe to say they're in a very different key than in Bruges, which has definitely gone on to amass a real cult fandom after a pretty quiet U.S. release when it premiered. And yeah, it's definitely positioned that way by Searchlight. I know that they really believe in the movie, and I think anyone who's expecting like Frances McDormand cursing at children at an elementary school should adjust their expectations a little bit. It is not that, but it is still what those more familiar with McDonough, more broadly familiar with his work, I don't think they'd be terribly surprised by what the movie is.
We've talked a little bit about the Netflix slate, but I'm also really excited for what A24 is bringing to the festival. You know, I think they have been kind of up and down for, you know, what they bring to festivals and award season lately. But, you know, they have The Whale, the Aronofsky film, and also The Eternal Daughter, which is from Souvenir director Joanna Hogg and stars Tilda Swinton. So to me, that feels like it could be definitely something to watch. I think she plays a woman who returns to a former family home to discover long buried secrets. I feel like that log line applies to a couple of the films in this festival. But,
yeah.
But
weirdly, you know, that's what Blonde's about, too.
Also, I think Bardo is about someone returning home to discover something, right? But I think she's an excellent filmmaker. And with Tilda, that could be something to keep an eye on.
There's the fun of that also kind of being spoken about as like a secret film, you know, that no one knew they were making it. And then all of a sudden it was announced that it was happening. So I think, yeah, that's really cool, because Joanna Hogg, the Souvenir films have been highlights of their respective years recently. And watching her collaborate with Tilda, who is her old film school classmate, and also Tilda's daughter, Honor Swinton Byrne, has been exciting. But I'm happy to see Tilda moving to the front, you know, because she was sort of on the sidelines in the Souvenir films. So I'm curious to see what they do in that regard. You know, and there aren't, you know, as always, there aren't a ton of female directors in that competition lineup. So, it is exciting to see at least Hogg there, as well as Rebecca Zlotowski, who has Other People's Children. And then I'm looking at out of competition, speaking of female directors, and you have Don't Worry, Darling, the Olivia Wilde film that already has a pair of trailers out. Everyone is curious, you know, about what is this actually about? Because it has one of those sort of mystery box trailers where it, you know, it starts one way and then it takes a turn as some sort of sound effect starts playing, which is a trailer format I'm getting a little sick of, to be honest. But also people are wondering about Harry Styles. I mean, if nothing else, right, like Harry Styles in one of those wood-sided motorboats in Venice going to the premiere, those will be good photos.
Yeah. He's going to have a healthy September, because then he's going to dart off to Toronto for the My Policeman premiere. So he's going to have cameras following him from coast to coast.
I mean, we're being given Harry Styles and Timothée Chalamet at the same festival. I just don't know what's going to happen out there. It's like the cameras are going to explode.
And Timothy's playing a cannibal. So. Yeah,
that's
it's going to get crazy.
Bones and all, the Luca Guadagnino film. Yeah, you're right, Rebecca. I will be in Venice, and if I don't see packs of teens running shrieking down narrow canal streets, I will be surprised, because if both Harry Styles and Timothée Chalamet are in town, I think that whole place is going to explode.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, because I was at Venice when The King, the sort of forgotten Timothée Chalamet, Henry V-ish movie premiered.
Emphasis on ish.
Very ish. Script co-written by Joel Edgerton. That was madness. I mean, I was not even very close to the madness, but I remember it being real bedlam. So add Harry Styles to that mix, and I think that's going to be pretty potent. Also out of competition is a Paul Schrader movie, The Master Gardener, which I don't know anything about, but obviously his last two films have really resonated, The Card Counter and First Reformed, in a way that his films hadn't in a long time. So I'll be curious to see if he can continue that.
Joel Edgerton's in that, so he summoned it.
There you go.
And Sigourney Weaver is also in it. Talk about someone who has long deserved a great role of late.
That's exciting. Well, before we wrap up the Venice talk, I want to ask you both a kind of cheap question. But like, Rebecca, I'll start with you.
Oh, gosh.
Where do you see an Oscar in this whole lineup? Where would you right now in late July, what one thing would you pin an Oscar to?
Richard, I think I'm going to go, there's a lot of promise in this lineup. I think I'm going to stick with the Baumbach. I'm going to stick with White Noise. We've got Adam Driver and Baumbach combined again. It's an amazing cast. It's opening night. It's going to at least be a major part of performance, if not picture.
And you have Baumbach overdue, weirdly, even though his career is not that new, or that not that old, rather, Driver kind of starting to feel almost overdue.
Yes. So,
yeah, that's the
ingredients are there.
What would you say, David?
I'm going to go with a specific performance, and that is Brendan Fraser in The Whale.
Mm-hmm.
I think for probably all of us, the hype on that has been, you know, it's been buzzed about in circles for a while. Darren Aronofsky has wrung out Oscar-winning performances before. The narrative on Brendan Fraser, I think, is going to be really, really strong. And this is, assuming it delivers, at least in that respect, a really great place to kick that off. So that's one I'm watching, just in terms of the challenge of the role, and knowing how Fraser has not really campaigned for an Oscar before, but is a really strong personality with media, that could be a really strong combination.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in one scenario, The Fall kicking off with Brendan Fraser wins Best Actor at Venice Film Festival in 2022, that would be a really interesting narrative. So yeah, I think definitely eyes are on those two films. Mine is that, like, I would like to live in a reality where somehow Blonde is, like, amazing and Ana de Armas is, you know, transcendent and a revelation, and she swiftly moves to the front of the pack, even past Cate Blanchett as a orchestra conductor.
That, honestly, I hadn't really allowed my mind to go there, but now that you've said it, yeah, that would be an incredible run. I'm all for that.
Yeah. Well, potentially spoiling those actresses' chances could be recently on Station 11, Daniel Deadwyler. She's the star of Till, about Emmett Till's mother. That trailer just came out, which is interesting because it's not out for a while, but that will be premiering at the New York Film Festival, which I didn't think we were anywhere near announcements for that festival, but I guess we are.
That felt very TIFF to me.
Yeah, one. Right? It does feel kind of TIFF, but it's a strong trailer, even though I have seen plenty of objection online to the movie's existence. Like, why are we doing this? This is traumatic. Like, why are people being exposed to this? But yeah, did that trailer jump out to either of you, like, as mightily as it did to me? Because it was like, oh, I mean, I knew this movie was coming, but it's really announcing itself early, which means, I think, is a statement of intent.
I thought it was really striking. I was really impressed by it. And I think Daniel Deadwyler is such a force. I mean, those who listen to this podcast know I'm a big fan of hers. But even so, just in the 2 minutes of that trailer, she really delivered in a way that I think is going to be pretty undeniable, at least in the conversation for a nomination in a few months.
Yeah. And it can probably have a little more space at New York. You know, it's not competing with quite so much other.
And it might signal that the movie's a bit less biopic-y, to the TIFF point. You know, it's kind of the opposite of The Fablemans, right? Like, does this signal the movie has artier ambitions than maybe we thought?
Well, so, right. And Chinonye Chukwu, who directed it, she made Clemency a few years ago, which was a Sundance breakout. Alfre Woodard was incredible in that. Really, I think, snubbed for an Oscar nomination that year.
Totally.
That was, like, the biggest upset, I think. I mean, it was a tiny movie about the death penalty, so it wasn't that surprising, I guess. But I think one thing, when I read the logline of Clemency, I was like, okay, so this is going to be this kind of, you know, bland but important issue movie. And it's really anything but. I mean, it's really a stylized film in a lot of ways. So I'll be curious to hear what Till does in that regard. There was some Twitter backlash to the trailer. I mean, entirely understandably. And the filmmaker Matthew Cherry, who won an Oscar for his short animated feature Hair Love a few years ago and directs a lot of television now, he quote tweeted the trailer and was like, I know some people are not looking, like, you know, excited about this, and yeah, I get it, but, like, Chukwu has done something really interesting with the film, so I'm kind of guessing he's seen it already, and so he seemed to be an advocate for it. So I'll be curious to see how that sort of debate about this film, which is certainly very charged in subject matter and placement, yes, in time, I'll be curious to see how it fares. Well, speaking of trailers, Comic-Con happened, and amidst, I don't know, trailers for Dungeons & Dragons and other things, there was one thing that actually did get me excited, which was Wakanda Forever. A sort of mournful, because obviously the Black Panther star Chadwick Boseman died 2 years ago, almost. But also exciting, because it's a well-cut trailer with an interesting soundscape, and also just showing off the great supporting cast of the previous film that now seem to be moving more toward the center. So, yeah, did you guys, I've kind of felt like, okay, this could get another Best Picture nomination. Obviously, Black Panther famously did, first and only Marvel film to do so. But I was like, ooh, Angela Bassett seems to have a couple big scenes. Yeah, maybe she could get in. So yeah, what are your impressions?
Yeah, I feel like it definitely is on the road to being a part of the Best Picture conversation. I mean, so much of Hollywood, I think, is still dealing with the loss of Chadwick Boseman. Obviously, this cast has been talking about it. And, you know, I think it was a big surprise to a lot of people that he was not awarded the Oscar for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And so it feels like they have created a film that is a powerful goodbye to him. And on top of that, you know, Ryan Coogler is just a phenomenal filmmaker and was given that sort of appreciation for the original film. So it does feel like this is going to be a part of the conversation this year.
Yeah, I watched the trailer and honestly thought, why wouldn't I have Ryan Coogler's new Black Panther movie as a kind of default Best Picture nominee right now? There are so many unknowns at this point in the season, obviously, and he is a filmmaker who has proven again and again he should not be underestimated. He is incredibly deft with incredibly complicated circumstances, and in this film, there are many of them. The loss of their star, but also just having to work within Marvel and create something really distinctive and artful, which he did the first time around. Yeah, this trailer definitely reminded that he probably should be assumed to be in that conversation, and this film should be assumed to be in that conversation until proven otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that has me, well, the big thing that has me worried a little bit is that you look at Iron Man 2 or Avengers 2 or Taika Waititi's second turn in the Thor, chair.
Like, yes.
Like the follow-up Marvel film from one director, be it Jon Favreau or Taika Waititi or whoever, doesn't tend to fare well based on history. But I think this is a different thing. In the same way that Black Panther exists in the Marvel canon and it's in the continuity of its storyline and all that stuff, but it does stand on its own in a way a lot of the other films don't. My hope is that Wakanda Forever will kind of exist in that same way, where yes, it's doing its duty as like connecting this movie to that movie and setting things forward in motion, but like also is doing its own kind of whole thing. My hunch would be that that is kind of how they're positioning it, just because the trailer is a much more considered emotional thing than our most Marvel trailers, obviously. And I think the studio does know that this movie has to exist in a different way. And hopefully they knew that all through production too, and kind of didn't maybe try to micromanage in the same way that they do for other titles.
Mm. In our week of Kiki Palmer memes, and maybe this is me transitioning to Nope, but there was one of her doing these unbelievable impressions of Angela Bassett at her most hysterical in classic film scenes, like What's Love Got to Do with It, which basically to me was a reminder of how great Angela Bassett can be, and especially with a crying scene. And it looks like this movie is going to deliver them. So I would love to see her find her way into that conversation, even though I do think with Marvel movies, it is particularly difficult for actors to break through that noise. Michael B. Jordan, of course, was kind of circling for the first Black Panther, but didn't make it through. I'd love to see that.
The thing helping Bassett in that regard is, like, again, we were talking about Bombeck and whoever else, like, talk about overdue, there are still people who are like, she should have won for What's Love Got to Do with It all those years ago. And I wouldn't disagree. I mean, she's amazing in that movie. She's been great in other things. She hasn't quite had the opportunities, I don't think, unfortunately, that she should have gotten. So this feels like maybe a slight mea culpa on that would be part of a win. So I don't know. That's something about that trailer. And then we see a little snippet of a speech in front of a group of people. And I was like, oh, this could be her, something big for her, which would be great.
Yeah.
Well, David, you mentioned Nope, which means I think it might be time to let you go because you haven't seen Nope.
Blame COVID.
We don't want to spoil it for you. Yeah. Well, yeah. I say nope to COVID. so should you. So we'll let you go. And then Rebecca and I will have a little chat about that film.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with the romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman. And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so Rebecca, we've both seen this very buzzed about, very secretive, until probably that last trailer. I think that one, maybe it was an international trailer, kind of gave away too much for my taste. But a lot of people have seen it. It did pretty well over its opening weekend. So now that we can talk a little more freely about the film, I'm curious what you think of it, and has it changed at all in your mind since you first saw it?
It's interesting, as I went to the LA premiere of this, and first of all, wonderful film to see with people. Like, I don't go to that many movies in sort of packed theaters, you know, as many as I used to. And just the laughter, the jumping in your seats, like, this is a movie to obviously see in a theater if you can. And I walked out of it really, really impressed, and especially with the acting performances. I think we've all talked about Kiki Palmer as much as humanly possible, but, you know, she's not only great at an interview, she is, like, really wonderful in this film. And I hope it gets many more leading roles after this. And Daniel Kaluuya, I think, is one of the most consistent actors in every movie he's in, and does it again in sort of a different way with this one. I had a lot of questions, and I think that's what Peele wants to do with his films. He doesn't want you to have it all figured out when you walk out of the theater. I would say there was, oh, we can spoil things, right? The storyline with Gordo did not work as well for me when I walked out of the theater. I was like, I did not enjoy that storyline about the murderous monkey. But, you know, this, with Peele's films, I go and I read interviews. I read like as many articles as I can after I see them, because I do think there is so much to dig into. And he said that he added that storyline to make you feel uncomfortable. And that's exactly what it did for me and why I hated it. So now I would say my appreciation has definitely grown as I've sort of sat with the film and read more on it. Richard, what about you? I read your review, but I'd love to hear from you what your sort of general take was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I probably owe it a second viewing, you know, mm-hmm. because it is so dense with themes and ideas and motifs and all this, you know, there's just so much detail in it that on first viewing, and, you know, I'm not complaining, but it's just, you have to, you know, I had to turn that review around kind of quickly because there's an embargo that's up early the next morning or whatever. So I didn't get as much time to think about it. But like in that initial, let's say 12 something hours, like I just didn't feel like a lot of that stuff hung together. It's interesting that you say that he kind of added the Gordo thing, you know, which wasn't initially part of the movie's landscape. And I think kind of a lot of the movie feels like that. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, I could do this and I could do this. And then I'll sort of find a way to tie it together. And I don't know if it really did that for me. And I did feel the same way about Us. You know, I think Peele is such a talented filmmaker on so many levels. I mean, I say in my review, like, he's just so good at like taking genre conventions and your typical scene of discovery or whatever it is in the early stretches of one of these movies and kind of just turning it at a weird angle or sort of, it feels sometimes like the camera is moving to see a side of something we don't normally see. And that's really exciting. I think that what maybe has tripped him up, for me at least, in his last two movies, is that were in his mind, the sort of the scope of his ambition, sometimes I think gets the better of the story he's trying to tell. And I love a movie where you have to kind of parse it out later and that reading things helps, you know, to sort of supplement or explain things. I think there's nothing wrong with a movie that's sort of withholding about what it's really about. But I also don't know if we should be asked to do quite so much work to help this film make sense. And so I think maybe some editing of the text itself would benefit it. But that said, some of the set pieces are incredible. I think that opening, not opening, but it's kind of one of the first introductions to this thing in the sky when Daniel Kaluuya's character is out in the valley and it's nighttime and there are just lights in the distance and ominous sounds and the sky is, you know, midnight blue. And that stuff is so good and is really where the kind of homage to Spielberg and M. Night Shyamalan, I think, reads the best.
Yeah, I think he's such an intelligent and like beautiful filmmaker. And I mean, when you start out your career, your filmmaking career with Get Out, it's a nearly perfect film to me. And so to watch him push beyond what he's already done is so admirable to me. You know, he doesn't have to keep pushing to make these films bigger and different genres. Like, I think what he's doing is really brave and really pushing his own skill in a way I admire. I agree with what you're saying. There's a lot of ideas, and sometimes that would take me out of the film while I was watching it. Like, oh, what does this part have to do with this? Or why is that shoe floating on the ground like that? Or things like that. So I agree that he has a lot going on, and maybe that's just, you know, the nature of how his mind works. I do think he is probably one of the best at sort of casting and getting performances from actors that I just think are nearly perfect. You know, I mean, I mentioned Kiki and Daniel Kaluuya already, but Steven Yeun is great in his role in this. And then a newer actor, Brandon Perea, has a really strong role, I thought, as sort of that Fry's electronics guy who appears in the film. And I think he's a really strong director when it comes to actors, especially.
Yeah, Perez is a strong role and a strong jawline.
Yeah, strong jawline.
He is a handsome, handsome man, as is Daniel Kaluuya, obviously, and Steven Yeun, who, you know, Steven Yeun's part is interesting because that's another one where I was like, I like a lot of what this is doing. I just don't know if it fits in this other story. And in that stuff where, you know, Steven Yeun is playing this former child star who witnessed this horrible thing on a set, a story that was definitely influenced by that real life story about the woman whose friend chimpanzee mauled her and she went on Oprah later and basically did not have a face anymore. All of that, I think, was so interesting and grim. But when it tries to lock up with what's happening with the horse ranch and those characters, I think that's when the movie unfortunately reveals some of its narrative holes or faults in logic. And look, not everything need be logical. There can be weird little loops of reason and maybe things don't make sense. That's okay. But it has to feel, I think, intentional, and it doesn't always here. It sometimes feels like an oversight, which, you know, maybe I'm being too pedantic about the movie and just, you know, auditing it too closely. But I think, unfortunately, because he had this huge breakout with Get Out, his first film as a director and a writer, and it is so airtight that, unfortunately, you kind of do approach subsequent films hoping for that same level of assuredness and holistic, I guess, competence or whatever. And I don't know that his subsequent two films have delivered that. But I would be curious to see what he did working with another writer. You know, same directorial technique, maybe another voice in that part of the process, to help shape things a little bit. And because, you know, sometimes Nope feels a little bit aimless, I guess, in all of its many, many, many ideas.
I wonder if the Gordy, I think I called him Gordo earlier. I apologize to the CG monkey. His name is Gordy.
And you apologize to Gordo from Lizzie McGuire.
Also apologies yeah. all around. Yes. I wonder if it would have been better as like a separate film, although I would have not have watched that film because that was such a stressful storyline. But I see what you're saying. It does feel like two ideas split the movie in that way.
I think I used it in the term in my review of Us, but like it's something that I've used to describe things in the past. It's like a junk drawer movie. You know, it's like you have that drawer in your house that has like rubber bands and one battery and, you know, whatever other random ephemera that you toss in there that you'll hope to use someday. And it does sometimes feel like he has all these interesting snippets of something and then he kind of stitches them together and takes a step back and says, is this a movie? I see that stitching too plainly, but yeah, if you have anything to say to us about Nope, if disagree with us, agree with us, whatever, you can, or if you want to talk about anything else, ask us a question, leave a comment, you can contact us on Subtext. You can go to joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen, or you can text 917-809-7096. We're also on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own. I'm at Rylaws, David Canfield's at DavidCanfield97, and Rebecca?
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of where Katie Rich is right now goes to David Canfield.
Cursing at children at an elementary school.
I'm I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PR.